Welcome to Tilt Talk Radio. Today we've got a special episode for you. We'll be interviewing a crop consultant from Central Crop Consulting, Jason Fusi. But with me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueker, all with Tilth Agronomy. Right. So our special guest today is Jason Fusi. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Long time friend.
First time caller. Long time listener. No.
Definitely.
First time listener and caller. But yeah. So Jason, you've been a crop consultant with Central Crop Consulting since 1998.
Yes. Long time, you guys.
All right. Grew up in Royalton, Minnesota. Went to NDSU, go Bisons, right?
Go Bison.
Ooh.
All right. Yes.
With a BS in plant sciences, you have your wife, Sadie, and three children living in Wilmar, Minnesota. And in your free time, you like golfing, hunting, yard work, gardening, landscaping, and spending time with your family.
Yes. Can't get away from the outdoors.
That is a lot of free time sort of activities there that are all outdoors.
No, there's not much free time. It's just those are the things I like to do.
When there's like 10 minutes.
A little bit of free time.
Which you can make time to do, yeah.
I still enjoy it when I get a chance to, so, yeah.
You like gardening that much? Is it peaceful? What's the gardening part?
It's kind of that getaway, you know, where you can just kind of put your earbuds in and play some music and nobody's bugging you. And I got a pool right next door. I don't have a lake house or anything like that, but I got a little pool that the kids are in. And I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go in the garden right now and see what I can do myself. All my farmers, I help them all year.
Yep. And then
at the same time, my garden, that's my baby. That's where I can prove myself, you could say. So, yeah, you bet.
So you're not like the house painter who never paints his own house. You like to dabble.
You have to. If it isn't the garden, it's a lawn. My lawn's my baby, too. You know, it's as a consultant, I mean, you guys have seen that where you get judged.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Clients will still judge you on that, on your lawn. How is it? You know, but yeah, if there's a dandelion in my 2.5 acres of lawn, then I get crap for it. So it's good.
You fertilize your lawn pretty good?
Yes, I do. It's kind of about the same spread as what I would do in a corn crop probably. So,
yeah. But, I think we all run a nutrient management plan on our own lawns.
We do. I lose some slow release nitrogen, you know, and stuff and try and get it going the way I should and maybe do a little split application and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's all good.
When it comes to removing the dandelions, do you do – so Todd – is the one that introduced me to this trick. Do you take a soil probe and just like go right over it?
You didn't tell me this, Todd.
He's never told you that?
No.
No, I do the.
So probe through the root?
Right through the root, yep. I mean, obviously, if you have a lot of them, it takes.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that.
It's not your whole lot, but where you got those stragglers that the that the spray doesn't get. Yeah, oh yeah.
I call it chemical eradication.
You just.
That's all it is.
It's done.
They're gone. So there's just a few out there. So at the same time, you put what you do out there and take out what you can with the chemical. And at the same time, it might be raining afterwards. And then you go out there and spray some Prowl for some crabgrass prevention as well. So,
You like the yellow sprayer?
I do. I really do. I don't mind it. I might have yellow fingers at the end. At the same time, there's not a crabgrass growing in my lawn either. So
these guys probably never saw that.
We didn't deal much with Prowl, you're right.
No, not much.
No. Wow. Totally different then.
Do you spray a lot of Prowl in your area? Or?
Not as much Prowl. I use the Prowl on my lawn just because need for rain within 2 to 3 days. Mm-hmm. But in my edible beans probably is my biggest use of a yellow.
Yeah.
And that would be for just my edible beans. And you need it. It's a necessity. Just take care of the weeds pressure. Weed pressure we got, mainly water hemp and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Put some outlook with it and stuff like that.
Okay, so, sure.
Yeah.
What else crops you got over there?
My main crops, of course, are probably corn, soybeans, but I have a main source of sugar beets. Also have a lot of edible beans, fair amount of alfalfa. We are not Wisconsin, so we don't have the dairy that you guys may encounter.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we have a lot of the larger dairies that Riverview is probably the biggest operation we deal with. And it may not be what you want to hear, but it is. We deal with them. And so at the same time, A lot of those guys, so I probably deal with several thousand acres of alfalfa as well. And the silage operations are big in our area. It's totally different from those true silage guys just because of you grow corn. They just
grow it and chop it.
Yeah, they don't want silage hybrids. They want
just corn, and we'll just cut it as silage.
Correct. Yeah.
No BMR. No,
they want the starch.
Yeah. Not in that situation. They don't want the BMR. Mm-hmm. They want, because there's always a chance they're not going to take it, and that farmer would not be happy if he had to try and combine BMR. Yeah. Of course. So.
They want that flexibility.
Yes, they do. Mm. Yep. Yeah.
So, Jason, in season, what does your average day look like? How's your day run?
Well, most days I'll wake up at about 4:30 in the morning, and I do a little paperwork in the morning, just try and make sure you're situated your day and your week possibly, and take off at about like 5:30, 6 o'clock, and sun's coming up, and head out there. And
that's my favorite time of the day. When you're out in the field and the sun's just.
Oh, you love it.
Coming through, and it's calm and quiet, and you're just, it's tranquil.
Those are things that you appreciate about your job. Mm-hmm. You just all of a sudden, when you see that, and you take off, and you're heading to that first field, even after you filled up with gas, you got coffee in your cup holder there, you know, and stuff, and all of a sudden, you're like, that sun's coming up, and you're like, wow. You know, and there's sometimes a little bit fog out there, mm-hmm. whatever. You get to that first field, and then If you get a walk in it, you're frustrated because it's dewy. At the same time, if you got the four-wheeler, it's okay. And you just take off and know that, I'm going to stop here, hit like three fields, and you're going, and you just got not a care in the world. You know, that wind is always a big thing. Mm-hmm. Wind is annoying when you're scouting.
You probably have to deal with more wind than we deal. I mean, yes, we deal with enough, but you get it. You're close enough to North Dakota to that sort of windy area.
Yes. You just catch that extra wind and stuff like that. So it's frustrating, but at the same time, in the morning, it's so calm that you just take off and you enjoy life. And
you ever get that morning flyover where geese are coming over you? And,
oh, of course.
Yeah, where you just, it's like the beginning of a football game with the fighter jets going. You just got a geese flyover and you're
they're just quieter. Ready to rip. A little bit of whew, 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 and that's all you hear, you know, and stuff. Yeah. But. Yeah, definitely. Those are
higher percentage of falling debris from that flyover, though.
I prefer those. Prefer not to experience that. So, yeah.
The morning paperwork. Do you set I'm going to sit and do that for 45 minutes, and then that can get away on you really quick.
It'd be 10 o'clock before you know it. Yeah, some days.
Definitely.
Just because the amount of paperwork you could do, but.
You could get busy every morning doing that, but at the same time, you have your hired help coming in.
Yep.
I have a full-time employee as well. He comes in and scouts. He's with me all year, so it's at least that consistency of seeing that he's there scouting. He's there during the later fall sampling and stuff like that, but you enjoy that consistency with him. I got a secretary that I always have in my truck. And usually she gets there at the same time, 6 o'clock, I say, or something like that, or 5:15, or 5:45, I should say. And all of a sudden, they're going to be there, so you just say, okay, now it's time to cut it off. Now I got to go out to the truck. So they're my trigger to get out to the truck, and I say, okay, now it's time to go scout.
Time to go look at fields.
Yeah.
As part of that morning paperwork, are you planning your day that morning? Do you do that the day before? Do you do it a week ahead? What do you?
Usually the day before or the morning of. The day before, and that's where there's so many guys that I work with, the consultants on the central staff that do not have secretaries, pickup secretaries we call them, and they sit in the truck all day, and they make it bored out of their gourd. But at the same time, they do so many little things that help me out. And one of those is the day before planning that next day, saying, okay, here's your fields. You already told me what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
And they list that whole list of fields. And after that, I just kind of take it and I kind of figure it out field by field, stop by stop, what we're going to do.
Sure.
And so it's kind of figured out the day before and right away in the morning, and then we're good to go. And you take off and go do your job.
So what's your favorite crop to scout? Like, what's do you
edible beans?
Yes.
That was quick.
Yes, there was no hesitation.
That's not what I would have guessed.
You can say least favorite, and I'll say sugar beets right off the bat.
So that's shocking, actually. I mean, edible beans are are finicky.
Yes.
And I would think sugar beets are very finicky. So what sets those two being the top and the bottom?
I would say the edible beans, I have a better plan of what I can do. I have tools that I can use to fix problems that might come about. A lot of the growers I work with, they count on me to give them that guidance and that timing. The timing is critical in edible beans as well. And so I get that out there, and they respond accordingly, hopefully, if the weather allows them to. And then all of a sudden, things are a success, and they're like, they worked wonderful, and they're happy, I'm happy. Sugar beets,
your hands are tied?
Yes, they are
tied. You just can't do much.
No, you spray it, and you're like, okay, that didn't work. And I did everything good there.
And it didn't work again.
No, and it didn't work again. And you spray a third time, and you're like, well, I guess this is what we're dealt. The cards were dealt with. So, yeah. So it's frustrating. It can be a rewarding crop as well. Don't get me wrong. But every crop is rewarding. I mean, we see that in our jobs, that we have rewarding instances, and we have times of possible failure that we did everything we could, and we just can't. Mother Nature beat us. How about that?
Yeah.
So, we're going to have that in our entire careers. There's no doubt about it.
But, yeah, she gets the last word most times.
It's very humbling, that's for sure. It just, it seems like you feel like certain seasons you got answers, and certain seasons you can't get out. Yeah, just
you can't.
Mother Nature wins, is right.
Yep, that's right. That's right. So,
what made you decide to want to be a crop consultant, crop scout?
Well, I can tell you my short history there, that I got out of, when I got done with high school, I grew up on a dairy farm we had golden plump chickens as well. And so I was milking cows.
That'd be my hell, Todd.
Bill, you didn't know.
I don't know if you know this, Jason. Bill is deathly afraid of chickens.
Like, some people have like arachnophobia, like spider. Mine is legitimately chickens. And we've talked about this on this podcast before. Yes, that would be my hell.
I mean, mine wouldn't have scared you. We only had 44,000 for
it. My grandma had like 44.
Okay.
And that was enough to do it.
And that was only one flock. And that, we had five flocks a year. So we had over 200,000 chickens a year.
Wow.
Okay.
How many dairy cows?
We only had 48.
That's still enough.
So, I mean, back in the day, it wasn't a big farm, but at the same time,
that's substantial. Still milk,
just
stanchion barn.
Yeah, milking. It was stanchion barn, and you went and milked those cows, and then... Yeah.
Red barn? Did Minnesotans have red barns?
Ours was red. It was concrete at the bottom, 18-inch thick concrete walls, that great insulation property, It would actually... You'd see a little frost in there about probably April. Finally, it wore through that cold, and stuff. But it was good. I loved it.
Jason, Bill, did you know Jason grew up on a dairy farm?
No.
It was awesome.
No. Most people don't. I haven't talked about that. It just,
When did your dad sell the cows?
The day
you left.
The day I left. It was. Yes, he pretty well told me when I was leaving for college that we're getting rid of the dairy cows. We had seven kids in our family, so once I left, my three younger brothers after that, they were
smooth sailing for them.
They did. They helped out with the crop some, but I can tell you right now that Jason did most of the work back in the day when it was coming to the farm. I learned a lot of great work ethic way, too.
Sure.
And so
What type of milking equipment did you have out there?
Just a pipeline system.
Pipeline. Surge or D-LaValve.
It was Surge.
O-matic. Surge out there.
Yes, it was.
No, and they wouldn't have had automatic takeoffs, right?
No, they were not. Yeah. Went out there and put them on, and then you released it, and dropped it, and took it to the next one.
Probably six units. What did you have for me?
We had only four.
It's only 48 cows. Yes.
True.
Yeah.
It was a big day when we got... Two more, Jason, and went to eight.
Yep.
Yeah.
You it still couldn't keep forever,
could
and then
keep
we got
up
eight.
With them anyways. No. It did really bad.
Yeah, so it was a great learning experience. It was, like I said, once again, work ethic. It's amazing nowadays how you look at society and the work ethic of people out there. I hate saying it, but there's a lot of poor work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
But I appreciate what I was experienced and given to me when I was younger, too. So, yeah.
Is anyone else in your family? You mentioned you had several siblings, seven total in your family.
Seven kids, yes.
Anybody else in the ag field, or you?
Yes, my brother took over the family farm, Okay. And I originally went to college for criminal justice.
Okay.
Yeah, I was.
We're learning lots about Jason,
I
like, Todd.
Yeah. I always don't tell you. I just talk and talk and talk. I never tell you about my old history and stuff like that. But no, I went.
Do you want to be like a police officer?
No,
like,
I did not. Yeah, I was going for something federal, FBI, DEA, Secret Service. Yeah, that's like what I was.
Hardcore stuff.
ATF. I could see you in that role. Yeah,
and I was, because I was in the military for 8 years before. I mean, like when I first started, I was in the Army National Guard. Yeah. And so I wanted to be on that federal side, but I blew out my knee, and all of a sudden I went from high on the list with military experience and wanting to do federal and decent grades to, oh, you have a bum knee, to way down on the totem pole.
Sure.
Yes, and so all of a sudden my only choices were to go for highway patrol, local policeman, and I just didn't want to do that. And not that I respect every one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a hard job. At the
same time, that's not what I wanted. And I loved farming. Dad wasn't ready to retire. My brother Mike was coming up the reins, and I was like, yep, I don't have a chance to take over the family farm. I love to talk too much, if you guys haven't noticed that already on the podcast here. But at the same time, I really just did enjoy talking to farmers and helping them out and talking to people. And that's kind of where it led me to. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
So in your career that's been since 1998, what have you guys seen as trends or changes in the industry that have made a big impact on your career? Has there been anything that really stands out to you as like, oh, this was great? Or
yeah, there's multiple things, of course. I mean, when you first start, 98, there was Precision Ag that was out there.
Yeah.
But we're talking about variable rate spreaders that were just not as accurate as you want them to be.
I remember you using big old, what were they, TF cards? I don't even remember. Oh, they weren't SD cards. They were, you had to like manually put on.
They were a big 3x5 disc.
Yeah, you were using, right.
You tried to fit in there and stuff.
Right.
And hoping that the accuracy was there. And at the same time, then you get an operator in there that didn't care about it.
Right.
And so the operator is just as important.
Well, they didn't believe in it, that's for sure.
No, they didn't. They didn't. And you could believe everything you wanted to about the data that you were providing and the accuracy that you were hopefully trying to attain. But if you don't have the operator in there or the equipment, you're going to fail. And so over those years, yes, we've greatly advanced that. I mean, nowadays we look at it and you know, I'd say 5-10 years ago even, I've talked to co-ops and said, hey, you guys, how are we doing? How are our spread maps? Are we doing okay? Because I want accuracy. Mm-hmm. I want people to be happy with what we're doing and what the, you know, everything we're providing. And all of a sudden, these guys would say, oh, you're giving me a map for 160-acre field, and I'm getting done with NPK, all different spreads, and I got a 5-gallon bucket left over. And I'm like, okay. Yeah, that's accuracy. That's the progression from 98
right.
to 2016 or something like that, you know?
Sure.
And so that was the biggest thing that I enjoyed watching was the progression of Precision Ag. Probably I really indulged myself in that probably too with just EC mapping, grading and stuff like that. Weeds, we see a difference in weed spectrum all the time. And, of course, water hemp from when I started to now is –
crazy.
Been a very, very.
When you started, did you see any water hemp?
Nothing.
Yeah, zero. Never. No. Probably early 2000 sometime you saw your first one.
It was probably 2008 to 12.
Yeah, so later. Yeah,
8 to 12 maybe, even. Yeah. And that's when we were like, all of a sudden your corn herbicide program was possibly a pre-down, but most guys didn't even do a pre at the time for me. And we'd come out there with a Steadfast or Accent combination and Clarity, Atrazine.
Yep.
And you just smoke everything, and crop oil and AMS is wonderful. And all of a sudden, there's this dirty little weed that came, and I was like, what is going on here? Why can't I kill this guy? And so that's when, luckily, we came out with Mesotrione, and you started seeing Callisto and stuff like that. Loudest came out a little bit later, and all of a sudden, we had a different tool that we could use, and it worked, but now all of a sudden, you scratch your head sometimes, too. Roundup was in the situation. I mean, it was in our scenario. But at the same time, guys, it was still cheaper to go the conventional route and still have success and not have to use Roundup if you didn't need to. You used it in your beans. So we try to do you know, good management, good IPM, but at the same time, I think there was too many people out there that just said Roundup
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Just kept hitting the same bottle.
Yeah.
ZZ.
Yep. Yeah.
Right? Well, I mean, it killed everything, and it was cheap, and it was reasonable.
And they asked me, why would I hire you if it's this easy?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, because we can do Roundup on the beans, and it still doesn't work all the time. But at the same time, the corn, we need to still control it that way, too. So
we got away with crop safety so many years, too, right?
Yes, like, we did.
Like our... You know, Jason and I's early careers, we were dinging beans all the time.
Yes.
And then we round up, we were like free and clear, and now we're back to 1,000 things in the tank again.
Yeah.
I think that looks ahead to the future of now as we're using more Liberty and Enlist, and guys talking about saying doing two shots of Liberty is going to be a potential bad mistake that we need to learn from.
Thank
you. You know, like certain things that, I don't know, what are things you're seeing currently that are things we got to really watch out for or make sure we do it right to steward these herbicides?
I mean, we need to, in my opinion, as I talk to my growers, I tell them we need to stop weeds from emerging. Sure. I mean, we want to stop them before they even come out of the ground.
Yeah.
It's a concept of what we always call acute toxicity. You know, I mean, a chemical in the ground it takes just a teeny bit to kill a little seedling. But once they come out of the ground, you're done. You got to have a lot different potential to try and kill that weed. And so if we can stop those things from coming out of the ground completely, that's what we're shooting for. We're using higher rates of pre-emerge herbicides and stuff like that. But there's times you can't get it on, of course, or guys will be stubborn and not put it on. And so we're stuck with a post program. And so Liberty Enlist is a great combination. We call it liquid fire sometimes.
Yeah, I like that.
Yes, but at the same time, we talk about the rule of 120, where you add your temperature and your humidity. If you're not at 120, you've got 70-degree temps and 30% humidity,
Liberty ain't going to work.
You're not going to have control.
Sure.
Right. You're not going to. That's the bottom line. And really, at times with Liberty, I want to say 130. I want to bump that rule up to 130, but it doesn't always work that way. But right now, I think our biggest trouble is where I do have Xtend Flex beans. And Xtend dicamba is not a tool that we can use. All of a sudden, guys are going Liberty. And right now, I think the industry knows that glufosinate Liberty has one weed that has been documented as being resistant, and that is Palmer amaranth. And Palmer amaranth's little brother is water hemlock, which is what we all deal with right now.
Yeah.
So the next one on the list is going to be Palmer amaranth. And so Liberty by itself is, I consider, one of the worst tools that we got right now, because it's going to burn us sooner or later.
It's so inexpensive at this point.
Yeah,
it's working well, which is great. But that's what got Roundup in
the same position.
So, yes, it did. You're right. Yeah. I like your 120 rule too.
That's a good rule.
Yeah, we kind of use more of the banker's hours rule. You want a hot day, and then only spray it
10 to 2.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, but you can still have the temp can still be 80 at noon.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had 25% humidity.
Right.
And all of a sudden you're like, well, why didn't it work? Is because we didn't have the humidity as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do think that 120 is going to be a banker's hours any day of the week. So
Why you got guys still on the Xtend Flex?
I don't.
They're
except my seed. Except my guys that sell. They sell channel seed.
Yeah, I was going to say DeKalb.
That's all it is. That's all it is. Got is it. Bayer seed.
Yep.
That's the only guys. Otherwise, everybody else does. I do have one guy, I'll admit, that is, he went back to Xtend Flex. He's a large grower. And Bayer gave him some crazy deal. You do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was better than the respray program either, even. And he says, yeah, and they're going to pay for that whole pass of Liberty. I'm like, oh, you saved $4. Really? That's it? But then they gave him a Bayer gave him a $20 bag premium. They dropped 20 bags, $20 off the bag. He paid like $24 an acre for seed. And
it's good seed.
It is good seed. Don't get me wrong. I was just,
you gotta yeah. So you probably are you changing your pre's and some other things?
Oh, to, definitely. Yeah. Yeah, we're going with a high rate of self enter zone coming back with some S-Met metallic core in there as well. Coming back with a Liberty plus Warrant combination.
Yeah.
Hoping even though warranted, we need the rain. I know that, but hoping for the rain and getting that pass. And if we need that second pass Liberty, we're gonna do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So it's scary because I don't feel as though I have the post tools to take care of what I need to when it does come out of the ground through that pre-emerge or something like that, especially if you get limited rainfall in the spring. But what do you do?
Yeah. We're dealing with a lot more plenish beans.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. You got any high oleic?
Yes, I do. I just started it last year.
Pioneer?
You are in dairy land, and yes, of course it is. Yep. And I'm over there where plenish beans and dairy is not near as large, but at the same time, we've seen a little bit of that where we're starting to get some of those plenish beans and roasting them and stuff for protein source and stuff. And yes, and I'm going to a strong pre, of course, and coming back with Flexstar GT back in the day.
Yep. Back at her, huh? you're in your heyday now.
Yes, but the good part about that is that these beans – you haven't seen beans on these fields for how many years, so you're going to get a Flexstar, chemistry that's actually probably going to work.
And they haven't seen Flexstar in a long time. Yeah.
As long as you follow that 120 rule.
Do you have rotation restrictions with Flexstar that obviously sugar beet's got to be.
I hate that. Yeah. That's the worst. That's the kicker. And of course, alfalfa, which you're going to deal with the same scenarios right there. Yeah. But and most of my dairy guys that would have the plenish beans would also have those concerns with the alfalfa and the rotation. But with sugar beets and edible beans and alfalfa, you get a lot of rotational restrictions I have to be concerned about there. So, yeah.
What's your normal group maturity soybean that you guys plant?
Most of the time, I would say most guys are 0.9 to 2.0. I preferably like probably about a 1.3 to a 2.0. I'm just not a big early bean fan.
Yeah.
I mean, we can all say that, if you plant them early, they're going to be great. And I see that. But at the same time, Mother Nature still dictates that. You can have a early – plant that bean super early – and it's going to mature earlier, but all of a sudden you get a dry August, and the fill on the bean is nothing. And your tops dry out, your pods don't fill, they abort. But then you get a late-planted bean, all of a sudden the late-planted bean works. So I believe in the concept of planting early on the bean side, but at the same time, Mother Nature still dictates your fill in August and September. They always say beans are made in August.
They are.
And there is no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can plant all the early beans you want, but if you get a dry August and everybody else plants late and you get a wet September, they probably will beat you.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And ours are where we're seeing the early beans mainly for getting winter wheat in.
Even
the corn soybean rotation. So,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
This early planting thing is, It's amazing to me as we're at sort of more national, with national groups at different conventions and everybody's talking about planting earlier. It's all soybeans all the time early. Are you seeing that huge push and wave too, that the more early beans, the kind of not necessarily wait on your corn, but wait till that's right, but just plant beans when it's ready and kind of April timing?
I think most of my guys are still wait to plant beans till it's ready just because how it affects them at the end is the same way. At the same time, it's kind of been weird. In our area, we've struggled to have a normal frost.
Okay.
Lately, it seems like.
Late? So,
yes, it's always been late. And it's like, everybody's like, oh my gosh, why are we even doing this? The beans we can't harvest them till October 15th. And I'm like, yes, I know. But that's out of our control.
Yeah.
You still try and look at the law of averages, and the law of averages still tell you that whenever you plant your beans, it'll probably be ready. It should freeze September 15th, September 20th, or something like that, and it'd be combining by October 1st. But, yeah, that's not always how it works. So, yeah.
You mentioned before, and this is actually how I remember meeting you, was the EC side of things, so doing the electrical conductivity soil mapping. And you guys,
you were our inspiration, Jason, for that.
Yeah,
you were. Seriously, I'm not.
I'll admit the couple of meetings when we first met, and I'll never forget Madison when we sat down during that convention, and I was sitting there, and I had about eight of you guys sitting around me looking at that computer. And I was like, this is so cool. And I was watching you guys just absorb
it. Well, we were just eating it up.
I was like,
so much logic there that I was like, yeah. I'm hopefully helping you guys in the long run. That's all I could hope for. But it worked in our ear, and it doesn't always work in every year, but I love it still.
Yeah. And you guys have done a lot. Like, I think, I don't even remember how many, I think we've done 20 some thousand acres. But you guys have probably done hundreds of thousands of acres. How many? What are we?
Me personally, I've done about 170,000 acres.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that is awesome.
Since 2000.
Not all with the Variscart, though.
No, Variscart was since 2009. Is probably when I first started doing EC mapping. I probably did about 100,000 acres with the Variscart. And so that's your disc. You know, acquisition yep. of the EC data. After that, we started working with the EM38. Honestly, I will not even tell you how that works. I just know it works. Yeah. I
mean, that is a weird machine where you just look at it and you go.
It hovers. I always call it the hovering machine. It's a UFO machine. Almost. But at the same time, we tested the heck out of it just to make sure that it was giving us similar reading, similar data, and that we were comfortable with it. And all of a sudden, we were seeing sometimes at times better data with the EM38 just because, I mean, the things that are going to hold you back on the Variscart versus the EM is going to be heavy trash situations, hard, dry ground where you can't get those discs in the ground. And all of a sudden that EM38 is hovering and doing the same thing. Now, the only thing about the EM38 is you can't have a radio tower within probably about a mile or two.
Sure,
it interferes. It interferes with it and screws it up. So we've done tons of EC mapping. As a company, I can't even imagine how many acres. It's probably over 500,000, probably 750,000 even. Mm. Back in the day, I was hardcore into it, and most of the other consultants on staff were not adhering to it that much, but I also had a strong precision ag presence in my area. We had John Deere that was really supporting us strongly, and just the adaptation of making spread maps, making seeding maps and stuff like that. And
was that your main purpose for the EC, was seeding maps, or was it other things?
No, it was fertility too. Yeah. It was both. It really was. And but we had the capabilities. I had local, you know, co-ops that would have four major 2-microbin spreaders. They could spread NPK, zinc, and sulfur variable rate all at the same time. You didn't have a blend. You just spread it. Every nutrient was different as you were going across the field. Oh, trust me, I was spoiled rotten.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But that was because of sugar beets. The sugar beets were a specialty crop that made people want to try. They made it able to work harder. How about that?
Sure.
You know, and try to really fine tune things. So I was lucky that way. And like I said, our John Deere dealership was great at that too, and supporting it. But yeah, and so that was always the driving force there, and that's why I took off. But now all of a sudden these other consultants are getting better capabilities. We got more people. I mean, there's a lot of growers now that back in the day there was only so many that had capabilities of variable rate seeding, and now most people do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hydraulic and electric drives are very common mm-hmm. nowadays. And so now everybody's doing it. All of a sudden these other consultants on staff are like, wow, we got to do this. Yeah, we got to do this. And now we've advanced our variable rate seeding too. So it's like, we're so excited about that too, just above and beyond what I used to do back in the day.
So. Sure. So is that something you're still doing a lot of? Do you still have new fields that you're always kind of having to go back to, or with the number of acres you've mapped, you've got a lot of it covered already?
So the fields you mapped are done. I mean, we have a great map on those already. That soil's not going to change. That EC is not going to change.
Yep.
You might slightly change it based on some tile, you know, You know, putting some tile out there and stuff like that. But at the same time, you're not going to greatly change what that EC is going to do. I think the biggest change that we've seen is that in the past, we might have used SMS to make like five zones on a 100-acre field or something like that and have five seeding rates. Well, nowadays, we're able to, we've created a where we take a yield map, I'm going to call it a good yield map. You can put a bad yield map in there and you get junk coming out of it. But at the same time, you can take a good yield map that you would say, usually it's going to be a drier year, that you'd say, that's a great representation of what that field does. And it takes the individual data points for the yield data and the individual data points for the EC map and layers them on top of each other and then creates a map based on that. And we can put a max, a min, and an average rate we want on there. You can play with that algorithm all you want, and you can get an unbelievable, accurate seeding map. And nowadays, the planners will do it.
Right.
Sure. So it's fun. It's fun playing with it and seeing what you can do. And, yeah, so I've loved it ever since the beginning. I love it even more now.
Yeah,
so
it's real. Matt was like our cart driver guy. Like he was our mule when it came to EC mapping, and he did about 2,000 acres for a grower of mine. And I just remember getting a call from that grower, and he's like, I'm planting corn. Every time this damn map changes, I'm looking at the soil and the soil's changing. Your damn map is right on. Like, so I believed in it. Yeah, it's awesome.
There's nothing better than feeling that sense of success that you hopefully accomplish what you can do. I mean, Mother Nature's still going to trump you, like we said earlier. Yep. But at the same time, water, you know, as a limiting factor, you can only control that so much. I mean, you can have a lot of rain, but your sand still might not be.
And that's what really scored for that farm is they would always complain about, like, we would plant just a flat rate, right? And we get these nub cobs that we could hardly harvest.
Yeah.
And he said, once we started doing the variable rate, yeah, we really notched back our seeding rate, but we actually got cobs that you could harvest and a reasonable yield.
Yes. And I think as a whole, as a company, our company has done a lot of side-by-sides of that. And, I mean, it's so easy to do a side-by-side nowadays. If you ever want somebody to test it, you just say, hey, these monitors will do it. Mm-hmm. You just hit default, and you can plant 33,000 versus both sides of that 33,000 or 34 or whatever you're looking to plant. You can do that variable rate, and you can compare that on JD Hops or FieldX or just query that on SMS, whatever you want to do. And you can see that true advantage that we find, it seems like. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think you guys pulled your Vera sleds with a pickup truck, right?
Yes,
for the most part.
Yep.
And we did the same other than the grower that Bill was talking about. I did do some fields with a tractor, and that was interesting getting that set up. With the EM sleds, were you still using pickups, or were you going to like side-by-sides, or what?
We got a Ranger, yeah. Ranger. Nowadays, we got a Ranger. We kind of just hovered on the back end there and stuff like that. And
That is another advantage. We talked about some of the advantages, but just the amount to pull it, it's easier to pull that EM sled.
Yes.
I mean, yes, you can't have
metal. It's not even, I wouldn't even say it's a sled. You got to be
right.
Because it hovers. I mean, I told you, it's a little UFO sitting.
I'm thinking like Back to the Future here.
Yes,
like
it is.
Part two with the hoverboards. I think that's what Jason's pulling around the field.
But at the same time, a lot of the stuff we're doing there, it's in season now. You can't do a Varus cart in season because you're disrupting the crop.
Right.
And nowadays, we'll focus, and the office will actually, I think we have six EM38s now. And we try to, you know, manage first it's the corn in 22-inch rows, and you manage that, and then you put spacers in there, and you go to 30-inch rows, and you do all the corn in 30-inch rows.
Yeah.
So you're not driving on the crop every 40 feet back and forth, and we're doing just in season. So everybody's like, oh, I don't have time in the fall. Oh, well, wonderful. We can do it in the summertime. Right. Yeah, I love it.
Let's go.
And at times, yes, we had a very wet year this year. There's no doubt about it. And it was tough to get across some of these fields, but we still got everything EM38ed that we needed to just because we could still hover across there. So. Yeah. Yeah, it was good.
That's great.
I see Todd's wheels turning. Like he wants the CM38 now, Jason.
One of the Varus always you did a very good job, Jason, of of promoting it and stuff. And it that's one sort. Bill had a lot of growers that signed on, and I did not. So I always feel like
you did not. No, you just had the privilege of like bringing it home and almost killing people.
Yeah.
Did you hear that story, Jason?
We're gonna go there now.
No, I don't think
so. You never heard our story of getting it home.
I heard about that.
This thing home.
I'm really curious, right?
Oh my god!
We had a road trip. So it was Todd, myself, Todd, and Bill's other brother, of the other brothers. Kinda, Nick.
He's in the middle.
The middle brother, yep.
And then Jake Geiger that works with us. I think you've met Jake. So the four of us, we drove down to Kansas to pick up our Varus.
Salina, Kansas.
Yes. And we get down there. We left on, I think it was a Sunday afternoon, got there at like 3 in the morning, slept for like a couple hours, went and picked this thing up, started driving back. So we're driving back on I think it was I-70 that runs through Kansas City.
Kansas City, right in the smack dam middle of Kansas City. Yeah.
And we asked the guys at Varus, we're like, hey, you know, can we just pull this behind the truck all the way home? You know, we don't need a trailer or anything. Oh yeah, no, yeah, that's fine. It'll work. So we're going. Todd's driving. I think I was in the passenger seat. We're going. Everything seemed to be going fine. And all of a sudden, I look in the rearview mirror and I see both ends of it just going like up and down. And like, slow down, slow down, slow down. And all of a sudden, you hear pop, and we're pulling over. We get stopped. One of the Coulters came out, sliced the tire on the cart, then went into traffic. Bounced off the center median, had like a concrete barrier. Bounced off that, comes back into traffic, and we get it out.
Well, we're all watching it at this point.
Yeah,
we're still sitting in the middle of traffic. Nobody hits it yet, and then you go, well, "What do you do? You know, how are you gonna? You're not gonna frogger it.
Yeah.
And just somebody just basically a truck goes over it, and then you see this kind of shorter Malibu just go right into it. Just smoke this heavy disc. Yeah. The disc goes flying off to the side, luckily, then. And then
We were able to get it off the
road. Yeah, and this guy pulls over way to the side. Luckily, nobody got hurt. Nothing like that. Well, this guy is way ahead that pulls over and kind of comes walk back to our group and kind of just gave us which you're going to be upset, obviously, at some, you know, what's going on. And didn't just kind of ask us very odd questions about I can't even remember the question. I just remember feeling like this, something
went right. It just happened so the two guys that hit it were traveling together in separate vehicles.
Yes, that's good to say.
And so they come over and they're kind of talking. And in the meantime, the state troopers show up. And they're there and they're kind of looking things over. And a couple of us are talking to them. They end up taking those guys like back to their vehicles and, you know, they're talking to them. We're talking to us. We're slightly concerned because interstate in Kansas, it's illegal to pull a implement of husbandry down the interstate. And they're looking at it as an implement of husbandry. We're explaining to them what it does. And so, okay, we convince them, you know, it's a scientific piece of equipment. It's not an implement of husbandry. So we're good there. Well, then come to find out at least one, if not both, these gentlemen that hit the Coulter have warrants out for their arrest. So they take them into custody, and they come over and they tell us, like, hey, I just wanted to let you guys know, you know, there'll still be more things to figure out, but, we had take those guys in, like, they had open warrants. They're like, well, that's for us, best case scenario, I guess.
It made a lot more sense why they were not happy and, like, something was up, you know?
Yeah.
Like luckily it was four of us guys there, and they kind of were sizing us up, but at the same time, like, yeah, just were like... They couldn't get away, obviously, and
because it just nailed the under.
Tore the oil pan off the one, damaged the axle on the other. I mean, it was not
a rental car, and just
destroyed. Yeah, it was not not a something you were gonna like just drive off the next exit and get fixed. They were seriously damaged.
So, with that luck of the draw, did you go to the casino after that?
You were gonna laugh where we went, but yeah. And mostly because of their brother, because he wanted to go there. But so we, the tire's shot. We have no spare because they don't come with a spare. No. So we Disconnect it from the truck, find a Walmart or whatever that has a tire setter. We're like, hey, you know, can we buy a new rim like this size and a tire? They're like, well, we don't sell rims, but we can put a new tire on this rim. Like, okay, let's just do that just to get this thing off the highway. Like, so we pull it into the parking lot of a Great Wolf Lodge because we call Varus at this point. We're like, hey, you know, here's what happened. And they're like, oh, holy crap. Like,
they were very good.
They were very good. Yeah.
Varus was great, actually, about it. They're like,
and they're like, just leave it there. We'll pick it up. We'll get, make sure everything's, you know, right on it or whatever. And then, yeah, so this whole trip of going down to get that, and we end up driving home without it. But yeah, so then we go to a Dave and Buster's.
I like Jason's idea of a casino better than
It was the opposite of a casino. Yeah, we went
if to you, if you David knew Buster's. Our brother, you go would
play skateball.
Yeah, yeah.
There. That's like totally what he would want to do. Yeah,
and we're all like, because we've slept at this point like 3-4 hours in the last like 48 hours, so we're all like kind of burned out. Had this whole experience, which was mildly traumatic, and yeah, it was just like
the lock wash, like some of the bolts didn't get tightened quite.
Yeah, that's why the coulter separated, and
stuff happens. But, yeah.
But yeah, that was a heck of a trip.
I don't think you guys heard that story ever before.
Is there? Yeah,
there might be a good reason for that.
Yeah, no. Is that something we'd like to talk about?
At this point, this is many of a year ago, so we've kind of reached the. We're beyond the limits of this story, which is great. So.
Well, it wasn't a total loss. Like, we didn't go home totally empty-handed because we, along with Varus, had bought a pH detector.
Do you remember those?
Yeah.
So Varus sold these. They went on the back.
Yeah.
I see.
The look on your face right now that nobody can see that's listening to this.
Yeah, we
is exactly right.
It's a pH and organic matter extractor.
Well, it was the one on the back of a four-wheeler. Do you remember that one or not?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Well,
we never did do that.
Right. Oh, that was a good choice
on your end.
Excellent choice.
Yeah.
It's a paperweight, basically.
We did the organic matter mapper.
That
I talked Central into doing that. And the reason I did it is because dealing with sugar beets, we were basing our nitrogen application based off organic matter and the possible potential of what you'd get release of nitrogen,
mm-hmm.
mineralization and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, the beet co-op's going to eat this up, you know? Yeah. And yeah, you bet. I want to be on the cutting edge here. I can do something better. I believe in it. And we started doing it. And I was the only one with the organic matter mapper, and all of a sudden I find out it was just like a corn planter, you know, a row planter on the back side. And I found out after that first fall that I used it that, well, you need to, instead of drive 10 to 12 miles an hour, you need to drive 5 miles an hour. I was like, what? and then I also found out that it doesn't like mud and it doesn't like rocks. Ooh. And I was like, okay, double whammy there.
Right.
Well, I mean, it wasn't good, and it wasn't charged enough to cover these acres. And so the organic matter mapper was good, but it also replicated a lot of what just your EC maps would do anyway. Sure. So I can't say it added a lot of value, so that's why I didn't pursue it after that. It ended up being about a $9,000 boat anchor, you could say, or shop after that.
Mm-hmm.
But so, yeah, that was one of probably my poorest decisions in my 27-year career here, probably. So, yeah.
Yeah, we feel your pain. pH detector was kind of that for us. It was, I mean, it measured pH. It did what it was intended to do, but just the mechanics of it was...
Not the way you wanted to.
No.
It's not logical.
We had to modify it, do other things, and... Yeah, it was a whole thing. But
that's agriculture, though, right there.
Yeah, right.
We learn as we go.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yep. Sometimes you just got to try it, see what happens.
You bet.
So we're getting kind of to the end here, but one thing, and I obviously don't want you to give away any trade secrets, but you know we're all working corn, beans.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that you've found over the years that you really think is important when it comes to managing corn and beans, like... If you're looking for pushing yield on corn and beans, what are some good things that you can think of? That
honestly, it's a general statement. Don't get me wrong.
Yep.
I mean, we got 52 consultants on the staff, so we cover a fairly diverse area. there are so many things that when I talk about that, this helps me. And there's other guys on staff that are like, what is he smoking, wax or something or what? And it just doesn't work in there. I mean, it's a lot of microclimate specific area situations that really do respond more than others. You need to know your area. I've really learned that over the years. You need to trust the person that's in charge of your area. Each of you guys is a consultant in your each area and stuff like that. And we learn our areas for a reason, and our consultants gain off. I mean, our clients gain off of that. There's no doubt about it. At the same time, if I had to say me specifically, my area, soybeans, seed treatments have not worked, you know, very well in the past. They just haven't. It's a good revenue source for the seed salesman, but we haven't seen the response.
Sure.
Inoculum, you use it where you need it. 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, whatever. Plus, but not every other year, corn and beans is where the inoculums pay off. Fungicide on beans, R3 to R4. Gosh, that one's consistent for me.
Really, that and that seems quite late for, you know, like.
Oh, gosh.
We don't even really test it at R4 because it just seems late. But, yeah, that's interesting.
We're kind of hitting that July, I would say July 20th to August 5th, depending on how the beans are, progressing and stuff. And we can a lot of times group it in with our aphid spraying as well, because I get to spray aphids all the time. There's a lot of guys on the staff that. They're like, oh, when Jason starts spraying aphids, I'm going to start looking. I'm always one of the first guys in Minnesota to see aphids. And I've had entomologists like Bruce Potter and Ken Austin that have called me and said, hey, just let me know when you're seeing aphids from the University of Minnesota, saying, yeah, because you're one of the first guys that's going to see it. So, I mean, fungicide has paid off for me very greatly in the soybeans. Now, when I talk about fungicide in the corn, that's like a hit or miss. It's a crapshoot. It's just like playing roulette at the casino. And I just, as I go south, you know, our consultants down to the south see a consistent response. Sometimes some of them will see a 10 to 20 bushel response on a yearly basis. But then you come up to my area and we're roughly at a 3 bushel response. I think we have over 1,100 trials we've done as a company. And on those 1,100 trials, we've seen 6.1 bushel. It's not bad, but at the same time, 6 bushel times $4 is $24. And
that ain't doing it.
25 to 30 in a lot of cases.
Yep.
And so it's not consistent enough. That's not even counting, you know, possible increase in moisture content, too, of the corn and drying costs. So certain areas, you got to test your areas out. You got to see what works for each one of us and stuff like that. Variable rate seeding application, variable rate fertilizer application. I think variable rate fertilizer has always been a positive. I truly believe in that, putting the fertilizer where you need it. There's so much variability out there. You guys deal with a lot of manure, and I understand that you might not have that as a greatest tool because it's, oh, it's getting manure anyways, you know, no big deal. But where we don't have manure on a consistent basis, because we do have a lot of dairy manure, we do have a lot of turkey manure, but some guys don't. But the variable rate seeding, we still have enough variability to consistently make that payoff. Gosh, it's just that one is so consistent. It's crazy. I mean, it's you might have a range. You know, we average about 5.8 bushel is what we're averaging on. Like, we're at about 350 trials right now with Central on variable rate seeding. And yes, your drier years, you're going to see closer to 8 to 12 bushel response. And in a wet year, you're like, oh, well, gosh, what do? We didn't want to short suit it. But we still see a possible 2 to 5 bushel response on that. Plus, you get the seed savings. So those are things that probably have really excelled in our area. I love seeing that, and guys get to test it. And when they test them, they're even in a wet year, I was like, oh, geez, I still saw 3 bushel. And I was like, 3 bushels better than 0, isn't it?
And yeah.
Like, well, you bet it is. Yeah, and we already paid for it all of a sudden. So, yeah, those are probably my funnest things that I work with in my career. Weed control. That's just a ongoing battle. That's what I'm going to call it. So, yeah.
No, that's a great answer because I think a lot of people spend time looking for that silver bullet, and it's not out there. You got to.
There's too many foo-foo juices out there. I hate saying it. Everybody, part of our job too, and I'm not being rude, but at the same time, part of our job as consultants is to filter through the BS.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of BS out there. There's a lot of salesmen that sell stuff, and they sell stuff on a whim, and that's their job. And I understand them. I'm not downplaying them at all, but at the same time, it's got to prove itself on a consistent basis too. Return on investment is still our biggest thing that we got to work for. So
I like what you said, Jason, in that right away you said it perfectly point blank, in that we live in a world where we're getting information from all over, you know, that guys follow guys on TikTok, or they saw this guy on Twitter or
YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube, these big yielding guys are doing this, so that'll automatically work on my farm, and it'll automatically pay. And that's, like you say, we've seen that too, that even what works for Bill's guys doesn't work for my guy. It's just, even that is a little different. However, I can learn a lot of stuff from Bill's guys, and I can learn stuff from the others, but that doesn't mean it's going to be profitable for my farms. Yeah.
You still got to try it on your farm, don't you?
Yeah.
And you got to still test it.
Right.
That's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
I hate it when the grower decides, hey, I'm going to put this out there, and he puts it on that field but not that field. And he says, well, I did better. And I'm like,
yeah, across the road did
well,
better.
Well, that wasn't a very good test. You know, come on, you guys.
Or lately I've been more do it on every acre.
Yeah.
You know,
we still got to have a trial that test in field, that true test.
Yeah. Being proven in just.
And not just one of them. All of them. Multiple. Those are things that prove itself. And so, yes, it's statistics and logic is what comes into play there, and that's our job, and we love it. And I think as consultants, we've always loved that. So it's just what we can bring to our growers sometimes too. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks, Jason, for taking the time to join us. Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
I appreciate you having me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Always talk, right, Bill? We go way back, and we appreciate your time, Jason.
Yeah. And you're always good to see you.
Get sick of me sooner or later.
No, not a thing. That would not ever happen.
I'm worried about the opposite. You're gonna be like,
these tilt guys just won't leave me alone.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. You guys are awesome. We may have a difference in Minnesota versus Wisconsin.
we didn't even get that far.
Cheese versus less cheese or Vikings versus.
No, we didn't.
But at the same time, you guys are trying to do the same things I'm trying to do, and that's where we have respect, and we enjoy learning from each other too, is what I see it. So you bet.
We're too much alike, Jason.
We are.
What's
scary?
Scary. Even in our area, Central was. You know, like Jeff Blinsky started in Central, Steve Hoffman, a lot of the consultants in that Northeast Wisconsin area, it was Central. And in the mid-90s, I don't know the exact reason, but basically they all kind of, it stopped. I don't know. I mean, when you talk to them guys, it was, it was, you hear a lot of different things, but they all went out on their own. And
there was differentiation, I think, and all of a sudden these guys went out on their own, and they succeeded, which is wonderful
And
it's good to actually still touch base with you guys to see that.
Yeah.
We can still be friends and be consultants and still be, you know, competitors in a way, even though we're not, because we're so far apart.
Yeah. But,
you bet.
All right. Well, thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, that'll do it for today. So thanks for listening. And as always, happy farming.